Hey, hey, happy Wednesday, everyone. We are coming to you a day late for a few reasons. One, it was a day after Labor Day, and we wanted to give everyone a bit of time to get acclimated back to the work week. Two, we planned to release a mini episode yesterday, but transparently, we had some AV issues, and we will not be publishing it for the time being. Three, this one was a little bit less expected. Your host, unfortunately, got a not-so-fun case of the norovirus this weekend. But we are back and better than ever. Anyways, on to Pathfinder 0015. Today's guest is Kelly Larson, the CEO of Aquarian Space. Aquarian is building internet for the solar system. And the Bowler startup announced in March that it had raised $650,000 in seed funding to begin building that solar system. The round was led by Draper Associates, which is especially notable because Draper was an early investor in SpaceX. I'm excited to dive into Aquarian and my conversation with Kelly. We touch on deep space communications, going to the moon, building logistics and infrastructure systems for the cislunar economy, using Netflix in space, yoga, and a whole lot more. But before we do dive in, you know the drill. Let's hear a word from our sponsor.
Our reliance on satellites for navigation, communications, commerce, and intelligence has grown exponentially in the new space economy. Unfortunately, the risks have grown as well, and the need for cybersecurity around space assets is critical. SpiderHawk Mission Systems provide space cybersecurity products for military, commercial, and civilian operators. Their OrbitSecure solution is the first to deliver zero-trust security to zero-gravity environments, protecting space communication, command, control, data transmission, storage, and integrity at the data level. To learn more about OrbitSecure, check out their website at spideroak-ms.com.
Kelly, welcome to Pathfinder.
Thank you, Ryan. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we were just talking before I hit record, and we briefly met at Satellite in Washington back in March, I think, but we didn't get to talk shop, so I'm excited that we are finally able to do so.
Likewise.
So I want to start, we'll get into Aquarian, obviously, but I want to start just high level, your background. How'd you get into space?
I mean, there's so many angles to that, right? So many answers to that. The reality is that I first got into it through just a love of space, right? Like growing up, I think I mentioned to you that I grew up on a farm. So I grew up looking at the sky and just completely in love with it. So there's a way that I always had this love of space. I was working in a doctoral program, studying cosmology and just geeking out on space and cosmology and how do we think things happened. So I had this love of it. But really the way I got into it was I met someone through one of my other businesses, teaching yoga. And she's my co-founder, Becky Strauss. And then she introduced me to her good friend, Michael Hackman. And he said, "Hey, you've built businesses before. I have an idea for a business. I want to talk to you." And we ended up just really hitting it off and enjoying each other's company. And so then he invited Becky and me to come in with him, and we're the three co-founders. So I really got into it through, you know, some sort of synchronicity through on the yoga side. And then it led to a really great journey.
Oh, do you think the lack of light pollution growing up on a farm, how did that like affect visibility? This is tangential to the conversation, but I'm wondering like if more kids growing up in rural areas where there's any light pollution, they could see all the stars.
Oh my gosh.
If that inspires them anymore.
I mean, I think so.
It's a fundamentally unknowable thing.
Seriously, it's one of my great treasures of my life is when I'm in really dark areas. And my farm was definitely good for viewing stars growing up. But I have moments, you know how you have those moments of beauty that just etch in your body and your memory? I have moments of being on a dark coast by the ocean out in the desert in Utah, where there were no lights and just the stars were so much more clear. And it is, I think it does when you see that, when you really get out into the deep dark and you see that. I actually have this dream to spend some real time out on the ocean on a dark boat. For this reason, because I just want to get lost in that view. And I think you can't help but get caught in the wonder and the awe. I mean, it just,
yeah,
what gets invoked there.
Yeah. That That's a pretty profound answer. And I'm actually going to probably ruin the moment here, but what animals did you have on the farm growing up?
So we were more, so it was in Iowa, and we grew mostly corn and soybeans. So it was a lot more about the plants, but we did have, I think we had chickens 1 year, and my dad wasn't too into that. We did have pigs occasionally, cattle occasionally, but small numbers. Okay. And then, then of course, farm pets, you know, which included sometimes the stray baby raccoon that suddenly showed up that we would, you know, nurse for a while.
Yeah. Well, there's some common ground. I mean, I didn't grow up on a farm, but in Dallas, we did have chickens for a large part of middle school and high school. And we also had a pet, a Shiba Inu, which most people know now because of all the memes and cryptocurrencies, but the Shiba Inu unfortunately didn't get along with our chickens. We recently lost our last chicken, but it was an interesting experience growing up with chickens. We didn't have any roosters though. And those are the meddlesome loud ones.
Exactly. Wow. In the city,
Yeah. And you know, the fresh eggs were the best part. The zoning laws are basically just no roosters unless your grandfather didn't, but we had no desire to have roosters and hens. So it worked out.
Great.
So self-described farm girl, grown into a yoga. Can you walk us through what that means?
Farm girl turned yoga entrepreneur turned space CEO. I think that's the line on my LinkedIn.
I clipped it. I clipped it short, but yes, that's the full line.
Yeah, no. I mean, I grew up on a farm, and there's something really simple and beautiful about life there, right? You learn how to work. You learn to appreciate nature and kind of the natural ways of life. And I grew up with a lot of wonder and curiosity and a lot of transformation, a lot of passion around helping people because of my own struggles that I went through. So then I got into yoga really out of a desire to understand how to support people to grow and change. So my master's degree and my doctoral studies were all in how do humans and cultures transform and change. And then likewise, organizations, how do they change? So then when I had this opportunity to come into Aquarian with Michael and Becky, it has been, I mean, first of all, it was just like, of course, I love space. This is going to be so fun. But really, I took those years of experience. Michael, let me back up and say Michael's vision was he wanted someone from outside the space industry to help him on the business side of things because he's such a cool visionary. And I've always believed that people coming from very diverse backgrounds, different backgrounds, make things more interesting and sometimes more successful. So we wanted the uniqueness of my yoga background in the space company. And I think it's worked really, really well for us. So then, you know, for me, the common thread is, how does life transform? How do humans transform? And I think space is transforming humans in a really powerful way. And humanity and the future experience of humanity is changing really fast.
Yeah, that's actually fascinating. And I'm inclined to agree. I, you know, come from a non-space background. And I spoke last week at the New Space Conference about this, about kind of bringing more people into the fold. So we're kindred spirits in that regard. Let's turn our focus to Aquarian. And let's actually just start really high level. What inspired the name Aquarian?
Oh, well, that was Michael, co-founder. So, you know, Aquarian is, we're going to go a little woo here. So,
love it.
In astrology, there is a sign called Aquarius. It's the water bearer. But Aquarius is about, actually, it's about large scale communication. And Michael's an Aquarius. And that there's also this whole, you've maybe heard the saying, the age of Aquarius. It's about a new age of humanity where a lot of things kind of change and evolve. And it is about these broad communications and changing humanity in a big and far reaching way. So Michael wanted to bring that into the name, and we were on board with that. And, you know, most people don't know, actually, no one's ever asked, certainly on a public platform like this. So people don't really know what it means. people get confused. Sometimes they often spell it wrong, and sometimes they think it's aquarium, which is very exciting to die.
Yeah.
But I love it actually.
Well, I believe I'm an Aquarius. My birthday's on February 15th, so that should make me one, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, then I'm a big fan of the name. It's my favorite space company name. Yeah.
Great.
Now to move on to a little bit more about the actual company. When did you decide to join, and what problem is Aquarian setting out to solve?
So I told you way back, I was actually teaching yoga and this woman was like, Hey, kept, she's very persistent about connecting with me. And that is Becky. She is persistent. She's amazing. So I met Michael and Becky years ago, actually really a little on the early side. You know, usually startup companies want to hit a market right at perfect timing. Well, we hit it early and we managed to survive, and we managed to go through a huge amount of the growing pains that startups go through before we were quite as relevant as we needed to be on the business side. So it actually set us up really well. So when we did our reboot in 2020, it was perfect. But going back, how did I get into it? I also personally in my life, because I'm passionate about transformation and I have a lot of trust in life, when the opportunity came up and I liked these people and I love space, I said, let's do it. Sure. Michael invited me and I said, yes. It was really about having, I guess, I don't know if it's courage or a little crazy to say yes to it. And then it was a whole lot of figuring things out because my previous companies were bootstrapped. So to figure out how to, raise money and build a space company and figure out how to get space customers and deal with all of it. Oh my gosh, it's been a great journey.
Yeah. Yeah. So the second part of that was, what problem are you setting out to solve?
Great. So, years ago, Michael was working with a team. He had helped to oversee the building of a satellite. And then the people that were running the satellite, it was out, I'm going to mess up this story, but I think it was out by Jupiter. It was somewhere far out, one of those outer planets.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they did like a 2-degree turn, and they waited 2 weeks to get the data back to find out if the turn that they made worked. And, another example is New Horizons, went out to Pluto, got data for 7 minutes. They got the bulk of their data in 7 minutes, and then it took, do you know how long it took to get it back?
An hour, 7 hours. Those are widely different guesses.
It took 6 months to get that 7 minutes of data back.
Wow.
So wow. Michael noticed early on that deep space data was a challenge, that these people would actually drive to NASA centers to get the data faster, because then once it got down to these big dishes, then they would have to wait for the data to get back to them through a whole other process, this like shared trunk line. And he just said, wow, this is a problem. And they were only getting back about a third of the data they're collecting. But the whole reason they're going out there is to collect the data. So he said, wow, what can we do to help this? And then started noticing what's coming at the moon. So Michael just kind of caught it early and saw that. So the problem we're solving is lunar and deep space communications. I mean, we're really, in order to go to the moon or to go to Mars or to go to Jupiter or anywhere, you need to have communications to be able to steer your spacecraft, to be able to get the data that you're going to collect, all these things. So we're doing that.
Do you watch For All Mankind by any chance?
It is on my short list. I haven't started it, actually. Okay. I'm going to soon.
Okay. Yeah, well, just to make things accessible there, and this is not really a spoiler alert of any kind, but I forget exactly what the number is, but like 8-hour delay in getting data, getting data from Mars. So the crew that goes there, if they face a challenge, that's all I'll say, but there's that delay, and that obviously exists in the real world too. So on that deep space mission, what are the chief culprits for the latency delay beyond just simple physics? Was it the case that the mission was using a government run network and thus was like lower on the pecking order of precedence and whatnot?
Well, there's many ways to this. So first of all, I want to say the primary provider for moon and deep space data right now is called the Deep Space Network, and it's NASA's Deep Space Network. It was put in place really for the Apollo missions. It has done a great job. It's these super powerful antennas on the Earth, and then spacecraft mostly send their data directly down to those antennas. Now, they are just very busy. They are in very high demand. So definitely there are some political who gets in where. It's around, last I checked, it's probably been a couple of years, it was 70% contested on the DSN. That means 70% of the time, multiple customers were trying to get access at the same time. So part of it is, part of it is just the speed of light and the speed of sound, right? Which were the same. And we are dealing with that, whether we're dealing with optical or RF. So that's part of it. Part of it is dealing with getting access. And then part of it is that we haven't been using much for relays. And that's what Aquarian's doing. I guess I wasn't clear about that earlier. We like to say sometimes that we're stringing relay satellites through the solar system, like cell phone towers, right? So instead of me trying to get on my phone and reach a cell phone tower in Africa that's super huge, but really far away, you know, there's one, you know, closer to me in the US that I can go through, right? So that helps a lot. And then in our relays, then we can optimize it. Because the problem is, okay, let's say we've got this spacecraft by Jupiter. It wants to have good comms, but it also needs to do all the other things it wants to do. It wants to collect all this other data and stuff. So it's not only focused on comms. So then we come and we get closer to them, but we're still in good view of the Earth. And we're optimized. We're just out there really to do comms, you know, communication. So that means we can put our money, our energy, our everything toward that. So we make it very efficient and it makes it better for our customers. Does that answer your questions?
Yeah, totally. So I didn't anticipate this having such a pop culture bent, but the Deep Space Network, those massive antennas on Earth, are those the antennas that you see in movies, like in the Alien movies, like out in the desert somewhere, I think?
You know, they could be. The biggest ones are mostly owned by NASA's DSN. You know, there are other ground providers, and we'll be working with commercial ground providers because the DSN is you know, unless NASA wants us to, you know, send something to them, we can. But largely those are so full that it makes more sense that we just, you know, do things really efficiently through commercial ground providers. But yeah, it's those like big antennas that you've seen. And they're great, but they're also obscenely expensive to build, and it's hard to find places in the right part of Earth to build new ones. They require a lot of space, you know, $500 million. And they're a lot to run. They're not, you know, there are more efficient ways to do things now with today's technology, 60 years later.
Yeah. Well, so you actually read my mind. We've already established that there is a shortage of capacity, but the other element here is that this is aging infrastructure, right?
Yeah, it is.
So what is the go-to-market or like initial launch strategy look like in deploying this network? If I understand, it's like the moon first, right?
Yeah. We're starting at the moon first. You'll see a lot of our, you know, website and a lot of our press talks about the moon. So it's the moon, then Mars and beyond is what we say. So, you know, the DSN, you mentioned, I should say a little more about the aging network piece with the DSN. It's still a very good network. It's going to work for a while, but it makes a lot more sense to use those massive dishes for farther out in the solar system. And then DSN said they will stop serving the moon in 2023. So here we go. And the moon, by the way, asking about the problem we're solving, last year in 2021, the moon had 13 rovers, landers, and orbiters on and around the moon from everywhere around Earth.
13.
And by the end of the decade, we're looking at almost 200. So that is, you know, it's a moment. People don't understand actually what's happening in the lunar economy. People that aren't tracking it is incredible. There are dozens of public and private finance programs from US to Japan and many places in between that are financing exactly this, to go back to the moon, this time to stay, and then Mars.
It's an exciting time, that's for sure. And I think, I forget who at NASA, but someone senior at NASA who is responsible for a lot of this for CLPS described it as like
taking lots of shots on goal in terms of how they are funding the next generation of commercial rovers and landers and whatnot. How does Qlips tie in? How does Qlips tie into your roadmap and strategy?
Great. So that was the question that I lost for a second. So first of all, to say we're launching in 2024 and then 2025, because that's really when Qlips and Artemis start picking up. So for anyone who doesn't know, Qlips is Commercial Lunar Payload Services. That's NASA's program that is brilliant. Jim Bridenstine really brought this in and his team. Such a cool way that NASA is embracing the capacity of smaller commercial companies and big commercial companies to just really be smart about this. So really the missions pick up and need us around 24, 25. That's when the relays are really start to be required, especially 25 is when the kind of big heavy things go in. So we have designed our first two satellites to be able to really optimize and work with the smaller data signals, smaller reach, smaller batch satellites, but there are still important missions that are going to be on the surface of the moon in, say, 24, 25. And then soon after that, there are these kind of big missions coming. You know, there are these cool commercial companies and NASA programs with, you know, big landers, like landers that astronauts can ride in, rovers is what I was actually trying to say. Rovers that astronauts can ride in, big landers that want to send huge amounts of data steady to the Earth. So we're designing our satellites to be able to meet both of those initially. And then our later satellites are really going to be optimized for those huge data needs that are coming very quickly later this decade.
I want to get into the bigger, you know, more ambitious missions and Wi-Fi on the moon and a whole host of other topics. But first, we are going to take a quick break.
Time for a short break to hear about our sponsors again. Space is the new frontier for cybersecurity. SpiderHawk Mission Systems builds space cybersecurity solutions for civilian, military, and commercial space operations. Their Orbit Secure protocol delivers zero trust security to zero gravity environments, protecting space communication, command, control, data transmission, storage, and integrity at the data level. To learn more about how zero trust architectures will revolutionize security in new space, download the new NSR SpiderHawk sponsored white paper titled Space Cybersecurity, Current State and Future Needs. You can find that white paper at spacecyber.com. Again, that is spacecyber.com. We love nice and easy to remember URLs. For more info, check out their website at spideroak-ms.com and tell them Pathfinder sent you.
All right, we are back. So in line with the Qlips discussion, I think that, you know, looking at a lot of these missions, there's a increased focus on the far side of the moon. And there are a lot of reasons why that is more ambitious and harder, and just the there's more complexity. So how are you thinking about near side and far side? Because I know that you'll be servicing the latter, and that's where, like, you know, NASA just released like their candidate sites for Artemis 2, I believe, and it's all, you know, far side, dark. So turn it over to you.
Say that's probably more complex for the people that are going to land things on the moon. For us, fair we enough. Have designed our orbit so that we can get that. So it's actually great for us to just, you know, so we're optimizing for quite a bit of the, you know, visible south side of the moon. But we're going to have regular access and regular view of the backside of the moon. So it's very easy for us to pick up those relay signals back there and send them down.
Walk our audience through what the constellation, like, around the moon will look like in practice, you know, how high it will be orbiting, where the coverage will be, that sort of thing. And then we'll get into use cases, of course.
Well, there are certain things that we're not sharing publicly. So I'm going to speak vaguely, but our constellation, part of our strategy has been, how can we do this in a way that we radically reduce the risk here? We're not getting up there to test out something new right now. Our customers need reliable service. So we have extremely experienced team putting together stuff that's all space qualified, all stuff that we know works in the lunar environment. And we are optimizing it for, I'll say that we're doing, like I kind of said it earlier, right? Initially, there are these smaller missions, you know, they're shorter in life. They're using S-band frequencies, and they're great. So we had a different plan, and we decided to even shift it a little bit so that we could maximize really serving our S-band customers in 24, 25, but also pick up those big Ka band.
Yeah, the art of the pivot. Yeah,
and so we can do both, and our satellites will last quite a while. So, so our entire constellation with our first satellite in 24, we can meet our customers' needs. They're going to get a tremendous amount of hours a day. And then with two satellites up, we'll have 24/7 coverage of everything our customers need.
Okay. I'm happy.
So two satellites. And then from there, we just scale.
I'm happy with that answer, and I won't poke on any more of the specifics. I don't want to get you in trouble. Okay. So the term Wi-Fi on the moon, what does that mean in practice? Like, walk us through like the applications that this, you know, connectivity, internet, on the lunar surface, like what sort of applications you'll be enabling?
Well, there's different things, right? There's, you know, we're probably going to be partnering. We've got a couple different partners that are looking at actually providing the connectivity on the lunar surface, right? So like, you know, rover to lander connected, right? That's a different thing. And what we're really doing is connecting the moon and the Earth and the moon, right? And then the moon and Mars and Earth and Mars. So we're really more between it. And we say Wi-Fi for the moon or Wi-Fi for the solar system because it's kind of an easy thing to get, but we're probably more like an internet service provider. So we're like you know, Comcast or.
Yeah. So like the last mile on the moon, I don't know what that looks like in practice, like the modems and everything. That's not really your focus.
Well, anybody on the moon that wants to send data off the moon down to Earth, we can be your person, we can be your provider. But if they're trying to send it to another thing on the moon, they could go through us. They could, for sure. But I would say it's more like, let's fast forward several years and say there's an astronaut on the moon that wants to do a video call with the family down below. You can deal with a few seconds delay, but you could do a live, you know, you can do 4K video streaming with our initial two satellites. And that's before things get really heavy duty and robust.
Yeah. So. Well, you actually read my mind. Look, there's an astronaut right here behind me. I wanted to ask about, you know, with human presence on the moon, the permanent infrastructure and just like crewed missions, is it too premature to think about like what sort of applications astronauts or moon residents will be using? Like I could see why, you know, video calling, why that would be important to talk to your family back home, but I imagine like astronauts somewhere, it's not going to be like Netflix and chill. Like it's mostly going to be mission critical applications. Like are y'all thinking through that or too early?
Well, you know, a little bit, we were thinking about some of that. I mean, initially, it's really about the robots and not the humans because they're not, you know, humans are still going to come a little bit after the robots. But then the humans will be up there and it'll initially probably be largely mission critical, but we are definitely designing and building an infrastructure with massive partners. Mm-hmm. To prepare for there to be whatever Wi-Fi and data needs we want to meet on the moon will be. Sure, you want to Netflix and chill while you're on the moon? We are definitely preparing to be able to meet that by the end of this, you know, as soon as people are up there to take advantage of it. Yeah.
Building internet for the solar system, super ambitious. What was it like raising that first round? You know, you mentioned you first got started. And it's a common line with startups, like timing is everything. And so you rebooted and, you know, clearly it's working out. You're in like building mode, I suppose. But what was that like? Take us back to the process of going boardroom to boardroom, or maybe just, you know, you were able to raise quickly. I don't know.
No.
Okay. I figured
it would be so fun. No. You know, those first years that I told you we started a little too early, I also got to, you know, eat some humble pie as I learned how to fundraise and learned how to pitch and learned how to, you know, redid the deck 100, 200 times, went through different pitch training practices. It's, you know, I think there are a certain number of skills that you need to be able to raise money. But it's largely just, I think it's largely an inside game. Yeah. It's like, it's really something about, you know, understanding yourself as a leader. I mean, having, you know, I would say that there are certain things, confidence, maybe even arrogance can help in a race. And there are certain demographics that are real out there as a woman. Women do, there are good studies that show that women get listened to with a more critical ear. You know, women get way less than money than men do.
Totally.
And I am kind of a geek for transformation. I like growing. I like growing as a leader and as a human. So it was hard. And, you know, we really hit our breakthrough moment last year. We brought in this extraordinary partner, and they're called Crane Inc., which is a cool thing. That's a whole other topic, but they have this, you know, 600 top aerospace engineers, and they came in as our first strategic partners and major investors. And so we brought that in, and all of a sudden we're a startup with access to, you know, 600 top engineers, which is kind of fun and interesting. And then we went into Seraphim Space Camp. Mm-hmm. And then from there, all the momentum picked up. And then all of a sudden, we had all these angels saying yes. And then we had, you know, Tim Draper and Draper Associates said they wanted to, you know, lead our small seed round. And, you know, it was not fast. It was not easy. It's a humbling process. And it also was just incredible. Yeah. One of the most powerful, empowering things I've done. And it's not for the faint of heart.
I can imagine. And it was, you know, a new experience for you having, as you mentioned toward the top of the show, having been a bootstrapped founder. It's a whole different ball game.
Completely different.
So how do you feel about, this is probably one of the easier questions I'm going to be asking, but how does it feel to have Draper in your corner and on your cap table? You know, that's significant. And they were an early SpaceX investor.
It feels great. You know, he's just, Tim is a really just fun guy. I went to his founders event this spring, and we all got to hang out in person because I didn't go boardroom to boardroom to pitch, right? I went screen to screen.
Screen to screen, true, so, true.
You know, for my fundraise, for this raise. And so we got to hang out in person, and he's just really a fun character, an interesting person to work with, and his team has been amazing. They're so supportive. And it's nice because they have such a reputation. He has such a reputation of seeing the really good early leaders. He has such a good reputation for having an eye for successful companies that, you know, it's great. Obviously it's a nice gold star for us as a company, and we love working
with them. And having gone through Seraphim's it's an accelerator. I always get it's not an incubator, but the space camp, would you recommend, first off, what was that experience like? And then would you recommend that? Those types of programs to other space founders?
So space camp, you know, one thing I don't always talk about, but, you know, you learn as a leader, I would say a lot of times, I mean, we all do this, right? We're all leading our lives. We're all leaders in some way or another, but something, you know, for me, leading a team, I listen to my gut a lot. And I had a gut sense that I should do space camp when somebody on Seraphim's team suggested that we apply for it. And I didn't know why, because I felt like I knew a lot about the pitching and, you know, they're in the UK and like, I probably, maybe we should do something more local, but I had this intuition to do it. And then I got on the call and they said, look, we're really in this with you. If you want to do it, we're going to really dig in. And we're going to really work to accelerate you as a company and introduce you to a lot of people. And they over-delivered. It was one of the most powerful experiences. It was also nice because they sent out this press release saying that our mission 8 had represented the top 5% of all seed stage space tech startups.
That is a tongue twister.
Globally.
That's a tongue twister.
It is a tongue twister. And it was a huge, again, like gold star for us and huge endorsement for us. So that was wonderful. But the accelerator itself, the amount of attention we got from the investing team, from high quality mentors, I was blown away. So I had an incredibly positive experience. I still am having incredibly positive experiences working with Seraphim. I love it. And would I advise this for other? I've referred several founders to Space Camp specifically. Mm-hmm. I think there are a number of good accelerators out there. And there are some really good space accelerators out there. Some are in different places, you know, some in the US, some not. Seraphim is doing their first US mm-hmm. Space Camp this mm-hmm. year. I definitely recommend doing it and actually really showing up, not just trying to skate by. Like as CEO, I actually worked a lot of hours to actually be there and sit in and learn. And I learned so much more than I would have thought. And it was definitely worth the time. And I would say it takes a lot of time. So maybe talk to some people that have gone through an accelerator you're thinking of and make sure that it's
the right fit.
It's worth mm-hmm. the investment.
I want to ask you a couple questions that you probably heard on the Zoom calls raising and then probably at Space Camp. You know, what percentage of Aquarian's technical roadmap is de-risked? And, you know, in terms of like the total capital that you need, you know, total capex for building, let's say those first two satellites, like what percentage of the way are you there? And do you plan to raise again? And if so, when? You might not be able to answer all those questions.
Well, there are some legalities around not publicly announcing how much you're raising. And so I'm going to say that. So we are raising, so we need $50 million to do what we're going to do. And we are, we will be opening an A, working toward that, sooner than later. We'll say sooner than later.
I'll take it.
So definitely having conversations about that. What percentage is de-risked? Oh my God, we have the most brilliant technical team and really highly experienced. I love them. And, we're, I think, as de-risked as you
where,
can be.
Where does that technical team hail from? Like, are there any sort of common backgrounds?
Oh, backgrounds, right. Hail from LA. Oh, Johnson in LA. They're in LA.
Yeah,
in Austin,
like work experience.
Actually, we're distributed.
And education.
John is our CTO, and then also one of our board members from the Koreans. Both of them, two of them, were program managers on TDRS at Boeing.
Okay.
So they were both, so TDRS, if anyone that doesn't know, is essentially the communications data relay satellites that are around the Earth. So very similar to what we're doing in the solar system. So we've got two of those right there in our core leadership. Quite a bit of Boeing and Hughes background. Very experienced team that's excited to be in the startup version.
Now. Yeah. One more question.
Oh, and then Michael spent, I'll say Michael quickly spent a quarter century at Ball.
One more question on sort of the near-term roadmap. Do you anticipate like government mm-hmm. contracts playing a role at all in helping to defray, you know, the build out costs?
Yeah. I mean, you kind of got to take all the angles.
Yeah.
Certainly we're doing our raises, we're having conversations around our Series A. We're talking to customers and talking about alternative arrangements there. We're having strategic conversations. You know, there's all these things. We're also doing alternative, non-dilutive, funding. We've got some of those already like in the books that we're planning on here in the next few months. And then on top of that, so you kind of got to take, I think it makes sense to just kind of do it all at once. So NASA, this is interesting because I don't know if you know this, NASA has an RFP coming out that's exactly in our sweet spot. That's really exciting. They're really putting attention toward, so I don't know if you know, it's the NSN, Near Space Network mm-hmm. RFP is coming out soon. The draft is out now. We're working on it. Okay. Yeah.
Vaguely. So, I don't know about it as much as you do.
Well, yeah, right. We're all the way in that right now. And it's really exciting, actually. It's because NASA's actually putting some money toward this, and it's going to be a little different than how Eclipse is doing it. They're definitely having some different guidelines. They say they want these kind of smaller companies to get in, but then you need to show previous track records. It's in a very exciting place for us to put some energy. We're in conversations with and working with a number of very exciting partners to go in and do that. So we're essentially, planning for the worst, hope for the best. I mean, if the worst is that we have great VCs we're working with, but it dilutes us more, wonderful. And if the best is that we actually, between NASA and DoD potential scenarios and, SBIRs, we can get some of that in at the same time and get and help that to relax some of our VC needs. Yeah. That's fantastic. So we're really doing all of it.
Myself and my colleague Mo just recently wrote like a new space primer for like a business savvy but non-in-group audience. And we wrote about, one of the unique aspects of building a space startup is the availability of non-dilutive financing. I think another one of the interesting aspects of being a space startup is typically you need to be co-located because most of these companies involve hardware. Now, for Aquarian, it might be a little bit of a different story because you are based in Boulder. I think as we were talking about before we started recording, you just moved to Minnesota. Congratulations on moving. I know how much of a pain that is.
Thank you.
How would you, I guess 1 foot in the geographical co-location in that part of the discussion, how would you describe the Colorado commercial space ecosystem? I've been thinking about regional clusters a lot more. And the second part is on the other end of the spectrum. What is it like being a semi-distributed, definitely more distributed than average space startup?
One thing I'll say is that our business strategy in a number of ways has allowed us to do that. So we were distributed before it was cool.
Yeah.
continued with that. So, we're not building our own equipment. We're definitely going with the philosophy that we are partnering with partners that we think are the best at what they do and that we know are going to deliver something powerful. So that allows us to be distributed because we don't necessarily need that. But we also do come together regularly because we need it. And we love the Colorado ecosystem. There's such a great group of startups in the space industry in Colorado. And then obviously there are some good legacy, a number of great legacy companies there. And it's just great. The state of Colorado is very supportive. When I decided that for personal reasons, it made more sense because I have a toddler and family in the Midwest. I decided to make this move for myself because it helps me to be more supported while I'm doing my job. And it was really important to me that we keep an office in Boulder because the ecosystem is thriving and because it's a pretty friendly ecosystem. I mean, of course, there's good discernment also, but it's pretty friendly. There are a lot of good resources, a lot of good partnership opportunities. And it's a fun place to be, fun place to have a startup.
I'm sure it also helps on the recruiting side, being distributed.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That actually makes it really easy. I'm just the best person wherever they are.
You mentioned Austin. I mean, I'm going to ask a selfish question, because I live in Austin. Yeah. So what percent of the company is in Austin, or is it just a few employees here and there?
So I mentioned the cream. So we have this really interesting partnership that I think this model could be replicated. It's really powerful that these guys came in as early strategic investors of us, but they act like co-founders essentially. So James and Jennifer Crean are the owners of Crean Inc. And they are both on our board and they're very active. Like I said, they act more like co-founders and they are just amazing allies and they're in Austin. And so then some of the technical team people they've hired are down there as well. We also have our board observer from the Draper Group is also in Austin. So we have some a good chunk of the people I regularly talk to and meet with and get support from are in Austin. So we are also planning some of our upcoming team together times, yeah. Team onsite in Austin
awesome.
As well.
Awesome. Well, I would say wait a few months because it's unbearably hot right now, but shop.
Well, that's what I literally said. How about January in Austin?
That'll be much nicer. We're bumping up on time here, so I want to get to the kind of closer show, palate cleanser type, more fun question. Yeah. And the first one is going to be pretty familiar for a long time listener, because I ask this most episodes. What is your hottest take or most contrarian view on the future of the space economy?
You know, my attention is on the moon, and I really believe, I'm a believer. It's funny because people either are or aren't. I am a believer in what's coming at the moon, that it is not just a few missions. It's going to take a while. I think that by 2030, we're going to be looking at a massive, robust economy on the moon and very quickly on Mars.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of our attention is going to go out there, and it's going to change everything, you know, from politics and laws and, you know, international relations to how we see science and how we see ourselves as humans to how we treat Earth.
Yeah.
I think it's all going to be radically impacted by that. But my attention is on the moon is about to get unbelievably hot fast.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking literally on the day Artemis 1 was supposed to launch today. They obviously stood down, but maybe they will launch by the time this airs. But I think just to double click on that comment, you know, NASA very recently said, and they've said this before, but like the moon is not just a stepping stone. It's like a destination in and of itself. I think that jives pretty well with what you're saying. This is the first time I'm asking this question. So who are space role models or a space role model for you? It's the first time I'm asking it. So
I love it. Gosh, there's so many directions I could go on this. I really appreciate the people that are stepping out and trying to do something different and just going for it. You know, the thing about space is it's a little bit like, you know, it is the next frontier, but the people that are doing this are largely people that are just like, I'm going to go create something, you know, and that's true for every entrepreneur. And to do it in space, I think it's a big, bold step. So, you know, I want to say, I really appreciate, you know, Megan Crawford going into taking the journey she's taken and the amount she's doing and bringing to the space industry and the way she brings her voice, I think is, you know, she's a really good example. I really appreciate actually just some of the other CEOs of these smaller companies that are growing fast in the way they bring themselves. I would say, Sassy Duggleby, the way they are doing culture. Are you familiar with her, Venus Aerospace? She's
familiar with the name. Texas. Familiar with the name.
Houston.
Not as familiar as I should be.
Okay. So Sassy, the way she is, the way they are doing culture in their company, I would say we're doing culture pretty well. The way they are doing culture at Venus Aerospace is so inspiring. And then her and Laura Crabtree created a group of women.
Laura's coming up on the pod in a couple of weeks. So.
She is amazing. And the way these two women come together to support other women that are, you know, including there's a bunch of really incredible women in this group that all inspire me because of how much they are supporting each other, how much we support each other. It's just incredible to be a part of that. So I would say those women inspire me. I could probably keep talking, but it's nice that all three examples I gave so far. I think these people that are just forging new ground are really inspiring.
I love that answer because Lord knows the space industry needs more badass female leaders. So that's a great answer.
Yeah.
Second to last question.
Thank you.
Will you go to space? If so, when, and would you go to Mars? That's like three mini questions in one.
Oh yeah. Funny. Part of me is just like, well, we'll see. You know, I live my life according to what feels, I really listen for what's right in the time. that said, yeah, I think I'm sure I'll go. Well, I'm sure I'll go to lower space, like Earth space. Seems pretty no brainer. Moon, I want to go to the moon. I don't want to live up there. I don't need to spend a long time up there. I want to go to the moon. Do I want to go to Mars? I doubt it. It seems like one thing, I just really like Earth. I really like breathing this air and having my feet in the grass. So it's a long time to be on a spaceship. And I have a feeling by the time they have spaceships with like real gardens growing on them and like kind of luxury cruise liners, is probably maybe past my time. So I doubt I'm going to go to Mars, but I'm a huge fan of the people that want to go. And I'm so curious about their experience and how to support them. So probably moon visits for sure. And I also want to let some things get worked out. There's a lot on human health that brilliant people are working on right now.
Totally.
And that I'd like to get fleshed out a little bit more before I go too far out there.
Totally. Impromptu question. And it's just, you know, it just came to me now. Do you think that more people in the space industry should take up yoga?
I think that more people in the world, I think yoga is good. I, you know, whether you're going and doing yoga at a gym that is like a fitness class, or you're doing like deep meditation, or I mean, any form of yoga is only going to help. But I definitely someday would love to see more marriage between yoga and space, and how do we bring yoga to space? Because we got to retain the human when we're getting out there.
Totally.
You know, like, how do you stay connected here to this body while we're disconnecting from the planet that brought us?
Yeah. Well, I bet you that there will be yoga classes offered on some of the commercial space stations going up into low Earth orbit next 10 years. But I'll keep tabs on that, and I'll let you know. Last question.
I hope to be part of that conversation.
They should consult you. But last question, do you have any concerns about aliens freeloading on your Wi-Fi?
You know, this is one of our major things we're looking at with cyber.
I was like, oh, wow.
Realistically, I know. Much more, you know, concerned about encryption,
like Earth,
and
Earth,
cyber
Earth-based.
For other reasons.
Yeah, Earth-based stuff.
Now, that said, you know, I think any aliens that are really looking to be sending signals across our solar system probably have technology that we want to freeload.
Yeah.
like they probably got the quantum thing dialed and we're working on it, you know, as humans.
Yeah.
But I think we're probably going to be trying to, you know, piggyback off them if we can figure that out.
Right. That's a point. That's a point that I make to a lot of my non-space friends. Like if they got here and they're here, like it's probably us that's trailing in the technology. Well, Kelly, This has been a great conversation, a lot of food for thought, and looking forward to reconnecting in 2024, 2025 to see how the initial mission goes. But thanks so much for the time. That'll do it for today.
Ryan, thank you so much for everything you're doing with this podcast, with your writing, with Payload Space. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
All righty, y'all. That will do it for Pathfinder 0015. Thanks to Kelly for being a great guest. And for the fun combo, thanks to all of you for tuning in, and thanks to Spider Oak for helping us keep the lights on here at Payload. Pathfinder is brought to you by Payload, a modern space media brand, and you can subscribe to our daily industry-leading newsletter at payloadspace.com. If you like what you've heard today, leave us a rating and review on your favorite pod player. It will really help move the needle for us. And if you're new around these parts, check out our ever-growing I'm looking forward to recording Pathfinder eventually, hopefully soon, with someone who on the other end is in space using Aquarian's in space Wi-Fi. But for today's purposes, terrestrial internet will do. Thanks again for tuning in. I'm Ryan Duffy signing off, and I'll see you back here next week on Tuesday. And not with Norovirus.